It's good to see you this morning. 90 years old, huh? Amazing, isn't it? I guess it pretty much blows all of our concepts of what mission is about, isn't it? It's not for young people. It's not for professionals. It's for all of us. I wonder what we'll do with that. Let's pray, and let's ask God to be good to us this morning. God, you are infinitely, infinitely more valuable than all other treasures on earth. And God, we come this morning and we just ask that you would be gracious to us. And that God, you would give me the words that you'd have me to say this morning that would be clear and uplifting and encouraging and challenging this morning. And God, may at the end of this, we may feel the weight of Advent. That we'd feel the weight of the cross. And it's drawing us to it, and it's calling us from it. Amen. Well, this morning, I have a pretty big task before me, and I got to be honest with you. And so put your seatbelts on, because it's going to be a long ride. And I don't mean long in terms of, maybe. But just want you to know that up front, and I'll just go ahead and put it up front. If my voice is a little bit off, I lost it yesterday, or beginning to lose it from playing football with some of the youth. And so if my voice goes, we'll just call it a day, okay? Is that cool with you guys? Just want you to know that. Over Thanksgiving, I was sitting watching evening television with my mother-in-law. I'm not sure if Amanda was in the room or not. Can't remember. But there are several stories, you know, about craziness of Thanksgiving, Black Friday. You guys get that whole story, right? And the madness that happens that day. Hopefully we didn't lower ourselves to such degrading places, but maybe we did. You know, several stories come to mind during that time. And two or three of them come to mind. There was, I heard about this lady who camped out in front of Best Buy on Wednesday all the way till Friday morning to, I guess, get a good deal on a flat-screen TV, and she spent like $1,000, and within minutes of her putting it in her car is broken into and stolen. Tragic, isn't it? The irony of that is amazing. Let's see. There was a stampede outside of a Target in New Jersey, I believe, and where people were running in and literally stepping on the people who fell in front of them to get a good deal on whatever they were trying to get that day. A mom jumped in front of some 200 people waiting in line at a Toys R Us and threatened to shoot anyone who would try to break back in front of her, to which she was arrested because she made a threat. And she just said, "I just wanted to make my little girl happy at Christmas." You know, you just got to admit, there's something tragically wrong with the human race. Right? I mean, we were really honest with ourselves. Like, you may not have acted out that way, and maybe I wouldn't have acted out that way, but if we look at the various parts of our lives, we probably have some crazy ideas too, and crazy things we've done. And that is really, honestly, what John's job was last week. To say, if we're going to really understand this Jesus thing, we got to get back to the fundamentally what went wrong. Like, what went really bad a long time ago. So we can really get and feel the weight of Advent like we should. My job this morning, on the other hand, is to help us understand then exactly what has God been restoring when we say that Jesus fulfills and fixes what went wrong. And so that's going to take us through the Old Testament. And so when I say we got a big job to do, let's go, okay? So let's just roll right into this. And the reason why is because, again, we want to come back and we want to understand that the Advent is so significant. And I read a great quote here about a couple weeks ago, and I knew I had to say it. It was by one of the pastors of a church up in Louisville that I follow, and I saw it on Twitter, and it said this: Advent should be dark and tense. I think sometimes we work too hard to make Advent, Christmas season, too light when it should be something very significantly meaningful and weighty. And he says, Advent should be dark and tense. Why? Because the world desperately needs a Savior. Something tragically went wrong a long time ago, and that's why we threaten people for toys. And that's why we do the things that we do in our own lives that are way askew from the way God designed us to be. And he continues on and says, the world desperately needs a Savior, and in Advent, we should feel the weight of that longing. Because we've all been longing, whether or not we know it or not, or sense it or not, or are willing to admit it or not, we have all been longing for that time when things would be made right again. And we need things to be made right again. And so this morning, what I want to do is I want to show us what exactly God is restoring. And that's going to take us through the Old Testament. Before we can understand what God's been restoring, we've got to understand what God created. What is this? What is the pattern that God put in place when he ordered the universe originally? And so this morning, I'm just going to assume you have read Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Okay, I'm not going to go through a lot of detail there. I think John did a wonderful job with that last week, and I want to make sure. So I'm just going to assume a lot on your part. But I want to pull out some things that you probably already know about Genesis, at least in terms of the general narrative. And I just want to pull some principles together, and then I want to inspect a pattern that emerges out of that, and then I want to trace that through the Old Testament. Is that, you follow what I'm trying to say? That's where we're going to go this morning, so see if you can follow along, okay? And you'll see it in your bulletin. You'll see that pattern all the way traced through the Old Testament, okay? So four principles arise out of the creation event that I think are worthy of our attention. You probably know them. You probably understand them. You probably been learning them all through Sunday school, learning them in Sunday morning Bible study, and Sunday morning worship services all through your life. But I want us to see how they impact the basic pattern that Christ has and desire God has for his created world. First and foremost is God is the author of creation. We get that, right? We all understand that you don't really understand creation unless you understand that creation is dependent on its creator, right? We get that. None of us argue with that. If we're in here and we are believers, we get that God is distinct from creation, and creation matters to God. Second is that God is the king of creation. Not only did he create everything, he rules everything. He rules everything. So implicit in him being creator means that you and I are automatically subject to the creator. I think we get that. I think none of us are going to argue at that. Also, we learn in the creation event that mankind is a special creation. He's the pinnacle creation. Now, here's an important point that we got to understand. It's not the goal of creation. Mankind is not the goal of creation. It's the pinnacle of creation. There's a big difference. We'll talk about the goal in just a minute. But mankind is the pinnacle of creation. He has been given us as stewards, gave Adam and Eve as stewards over the created world to rule under his rule. We get that. I think we all understand that. That's Bible 101, right? We get that. We've learned that in Sunday school all of our life. But here's the goal. And we don't ever really emphasize it enough. Rest is the goal. On the seventh day, God rested from all of his work. And in some ways, God's been resting ever since then. Okay, yes, things went wrong, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. And God's doing, and he's working hard to redeem culture, to get back to that basic pattern that he puts in place. But rest is the goal. And what is rest? Rest is mankind living out his created DNA before God, under his rule, and living in the presence of God as a blessing. Let me say that again. Rest is when you and I live under God's rule and as his stewards of creation, over the created world, and we live in relation to him. That means in his presence. We live in his presence. God's blessing is his presence, not his provision, necessarily. Provision is always a blessing, of course, but his greatest blessing is his presence. Now, if that's the case, then a pattern emerges here that we're going to trace. This is the pattern. That out of these four things, we see three things. One is, God has a people, Adam and Eve, right? He created Adam and Eve for a purpose. God has a place. He gave them a garden to go and to tend to, right? Got that. But then God also has a rule and blessing, okay? He gave them responsibility. But not only did he give them responsibility, he blessed himself with a presence. We read of God walking in the garden and communing with mankind through that entire time. And tragically, when we see sin enter the world, God's walking through the garden and says, hey, are you there? Where's Adam and Eve at? They're hiding. And so when we get to that, we got to understand that is the pattern. God has a people, he has a place, and he has a rule and blessing. It's there in the very beginning of time. It's what God intends the world to be arranged around, ordered around, is this God's people, God's place, under God's rule and blessing. It's a kingdom pattern, if you want to say it another way. But this kingdom is not about a like some kind of arbitrary political system. It's about relationship. It's about relationship. And the relationship is this. It orders our relationship with God. It orders man's relationship with each other. And it orders man's relationship with the created world. See, now we begin to understand what really went wrong when Adam and Eve failed. And so we keep on tracking that through. Your bulletin says the failed kingdom. I put down perished kingdom in mine. And from Genesis 3 to to basically 11, we see how things go bad. And have gone bad, way bad. But what went bad? What exactly is sin? If we're going to say things went bad and the world has rejected God's authority, what exactly does that mean? Well, let's find out. And looking at it through the lenses of relationship, it looks like this. Sin enters the world as an issue of lawmaking, not necessarily law breaking. You following me there? Sin is first and foremost an issue of me making my own law and trying to trump it over God's law. So we don't fight morality issues as a church. We fight heart issues as a church. That's fundamentally what went wrong at the very beginning. Adam and Eve saw it and she saw it was good and she let it change her heart. And she said, I believe I can get meaning and purpose out of disobeying the law of God. And that my way is got to be better and more fulfilling than the way God has told me to go. So three things happen here as a result. God's judgment comes on the created world, mankind and the created world as it is. It's the curse. Because a man is disobedient, God curses the world. You've read it yourself. What does he do? Exactly what was that curse? Well, he curses relationships between man and man, mankind. We look at it and see in the life of Adam and Eve. He sees their life, the intimacy begins to fade. Perfect trust is gone. Blame shifting, right? Remember? Blame shifting. Remember that happened? Adam looked and said, the woman made me do it. Right? Or, God, you made me that way. Right? It was a relationship that was broken because, and God's curse affected that way. And so since that time, relationships have never been the same. So it fundamentally broke the relationship between human beings. We see it also in the marriage relationship, but you see this not just in the marriage relationship. What did God say to Eve? He says, your desire will be for your husband. That sounds nice, but it's really not nice. Because what it really means is that there will be a power struggle until the end of time, until I redeem this world. And you will struggle to fall under the leadership pattern, the design that God has put in place between husband and wife. You will struggle with that. And it will cause problems. Wars might even start because of it. We certainly know denominational wars start over this issue. Okay? But not only did it affect man's relationship with one another, it also affected man's relationship to creation. Natural disasters. We cannot believe that natural disasters existed before this fall, can we? The natural disasters, and you know, we think of hurricanes, we think of tsunamis, we think of tornadoes that take people's lives and all that kind of stuff. Those things begin to take away. The ground is cursed, and what happens? It makes it tougher for Adam to do his job that God gave him to do. So his relationship of creation is messed up. Man no longer rules as God's steward any longer. Many times he is subservient to the creation. He's weaker than the creation around him. And then, ultimately, then, man's relationship with God. And that's what caused the whole thing in the first place, right? God turns from mankind then. He curses them and he turns from them. He can't, because he cannot dwell in the presence of unrighteousness. He cannot dwell in the presence of his holiness cannot be in the presence of unholiness. So our grid looks a lot differently now, doesn't it? Our pattern looks a lot differently. God's people now are, there really are no God's people anymore. They're all separated from God. God's place isn't really around anymore, is it? Really, because what did God do? He threw them out of the garden. And not only that, of course, that was all caused because they would not submit themselves to God's rule. And what was happened when God's rule is removed? His blessing is removed. And what's his blessing? His presence. There's a divide between mankind and his creator now, between creation and his creator. But what's amazing then is that the fell kingdom, as we get into that process, as this fell kingdom, it underscores everything up until Jesus, is that in spite of the fell kingdom, God gives us pictures from this point on of what he's promising and how he's fulfilling it all the way through the Old Testament. And so we get into what we call the promised kingdom there. And from Genesis 3 to roughly Genesis 12, 15, whatever, we can see, even in subtle ways, God's provision for mankind in spite of their sin. I wonder if you've noticed it. John noted, talked about it last week, that God would send someone who would crush the head of the serpent, right? One day, someone from one of Eve's children would crush the serpent. That would be the stronghold that's been the stronghold over mankind's heart. So the serpent crusher is on his way. That's Genesis 3:15. Genesis 4:15. Cain kills his brother. Cold-hearted murder. And he says, now you got to go to another land, Cain. Just kind of the same way he did earlier. And Cain goes, whoa, 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 whoa. Let go there. They're going to kill me. What does God do? In his mercy, he puts what? A mark on Cain. And he shows a picture of his provision and protection in spite of man's sin and Cain's sin. You get to Genesis 5. One of the results of brokenness in the world as we know it is death, right? Death didn't exist prior to the fall. We can't believe that, right? We don't understand the world. There would have been no death. It was the perfect world. Because God created it and made it good. But then we see this scroll, right? We see this scroll, and we call the who's who, I guess, of the early ancestry. And such lived at 800 years, and he died. That's encouraging. Such and such lived 700 years, and he died. More death. Such and such lived 1,000 years, and he died. But then we get to Enoch, and we see something much different, don't we? That God can even alter sin's curse when he wants to. He sees Enoch. He looks at Enoch, and Enoch walks with God. And what does it tell us after that? That Enoch was no more. He did not experience death. That one day, it is a picture that one day death and all of its sting would not exist any longer. We get to Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9. And you get to Noah, and God goes to Noah and says, hey, look, you know what? I'm kind of fed up. Mankind just is really, really messed things up. All right? He turns to wickedness every chance he gets. And what does he tell Noah to do? He says, go build, John put in our devotion this week, a big box. Never thought about it that way, but it's a big box. That's all it was. A box that floats with a bunch of animals on it. Again, another picture of God's provision. He provided for one family. He found favor on one family. The rest of creation was destroyed. Waters go away. God goes to Abraham, and here's what he says to him, Genesis 9. This is the first scripture. And we're going to keep the verses as much as we possibly can on the screen because we're going to cover a lot of ground. If you want to try to come along with me, have fun. But we're going to try to keep it up here in front of you as much as possible, okay? Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 3. And we see here in this passage the same thing, almost the same exact pattern that God put into creation. Look here. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Fear of you and dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives on the earth will be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. You see it? God's trying to start over here, Noah's family is going to start the whole thing over again. And he says, do the same. He gives them the same orders. Be fruitful and multiply. Make a people for me, my name. And he doesn't really talk about the land so much, but he just says that man will rule over creation again. The fear of creation will be towards man. They'll be fearful of mankind because they will rule once again. But again, also you see a picture of God providing. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. The same basic pattern. God's bringing it back to life again. But the problem is that sin still exists. There's been no substitution. There's been no payment for sin in a lasting kind of way. There's been no payment. Why do we know that? Well, look at what happens between this point and Abraham. And we'll just go talk about the Tower of Babel. Everyone gets together and says, hey, let's just show everyone how great we are. In fact, let's show God how great we are. So let's get up and let's just build us a big old tower. Let's climb our way up into heaven. And let's just throw God off his throne. Now, God finds that fairly comical. Okay? And he goes, like Lincoln Locke, just, all right, you guys are done. And he puts different languages in their mouths. They can't communicate to each other. Another indication of the brokenness between mankind. Now it's a language barrier. And what happens? Dispersion. All these different directions. By the way, if you don't believe God has a heart for the nations, there's a clear picture right there, because God's going to draw all the nations, all the different languages back to himself one day. That's why we go as this 90-year-old lady goes, even when we're 90 years old, to do it. Okay? So, we see that same thing, but there's still a sin problem, and we see those pictures as still examples. So God continues to build the picture. Genesis 12. Go there if you want to with me. That's where we're going to sit there just for a couple minutes. Genesis 12 and basically up through 17, God goes to a guy named Abraham. Well, Abram at the time. And he says, hey, Abram, I got a plan for you. I want you to leave all your comforts of what you know here right now and all the gods that you've worshipped and all the pagan life that you've had all your life. And I want you to go somewhere. And I'm not going to tell you where that is yet. Cool. Pack your bags. Let's go. Abram goes and does this, and it's just him and his arthritic wife. Okay? Now imagine that journey. Okay? He goes, and he doesn't have children of his own. He's taken all of his livestock with him, and they're going, and they go through this journey. And you can imagine as he goes through this journey, like insecurity probably like starts to set in, going like, okay, I'm way too old for this. But God begins to come to him, and he says in Genesis 12, 1 through 3, here's the message he gives to Abram. He says, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house that in the midst of the land, to the land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation and bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So he does this. And he gets insecurity and he tells them, wait a minute, you know, how am I going to have kids? Right? Isn't that amazing? How am I going to have kids? I mean, like, have you seen my wife? I mean, like, I'm not sure that's going to work, God. All right? We're kind of old, you know? I don't know what's going on there, but I don't get that. So I kind of see the picture like this. Abraham kind of goes up to one of them, you know, and so at this point, and this is where all of our control issues kind of kick in, right? God tells us to do something. We don't have patience enough to kind of wait on him to actually do it. So we kick in an overdrive and we try to make the thing happen, right? Have you ever done that? You're like, I know God's calling me to do this. I'm not patient enough to wait on him, so I'm just going to make it happen myself. Have you ever been that person? Don't lie. You have. We all have. Okay? We've done it in some way, some shape, or form. All right? So, you know, so Abraham's walking through the camp one day and he sees one of, you know, Sarah's handmaids, and she goes, hey girl, what's up? Yeah. See, I got this plan from God, and you want to help me with it? And then God goes, not going to work. It's not going to work that way, Abram. No. My plan depends on me, not you. And so he teaches that same principle to him over and over. And we get to Genesis 17:7. And he says, and I will establish my covenant with you, between me and you, and your offspring after you throughout all their generations for an everlasting covenant. to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant in you and your offspring after you throughout all generations. So God has he's beginning the formation of a people again. It's not just a general idea, a general pattern that he did with Noah. He's actually beginning the process of forming a people for himself. And he says, there's a land that I'm going to give you. So be prepared. We're going there. And you will keep my covenant. You will follow me and you will fulfill it. And you and your offspring, all generations will come after you. And it's like John said, I think John said this last week in his message. This is the first amazing, tangible picture of the gospel in almost its entire fullness. Isn't it amazing? We see the gospel almost as an entire fullness that is pointing to Jesus right here and right now. And we're going to flesh that out. Because what we do now is we're going to get to track Israel's journey through the Old Testament. But here's the key, and I want us to get this, is that Israel was not the point. Never was and never will be, ever. Israel was nothing more than a partial kingdom, a type, a shadow, pointing towards Jesus. And we're going to see that as we continue to journey through this. But so let's do that. Let's find out what God did to create this God's people, God's place, and God's will and blessing through Israel. Okay? So let's track through that from Genesis 12 to roughly to Exodus 18. We kind of see God continuing to gather his people together. Okay? Let's just look at some of the highlights there. Abraham and Isaac. He has Isaac, but it wasn't the way that Abraham saw it coming up to be. You know, can you imagine Sarah walking into the emergency room and saying, hey, need a maternity ward? And they go, hey, you got a grandchild here? Actually, no, I'm actually having a baby. Oh, all right. All right. But that's what happened. So God shows Abraham that this plan depends on him, even in the most unusual circumstances. We get on down the road, he thinks, okay, man, the wheels are starting to turn now. Things are starting to go. We're going in the right direction. Rubber's meeting the road now. No, hold on. Abraham, I want you to go up on the mountain up there, take some wood, and I want you to tie your boy to that, and I want you to sacrifice him. All right. That don't make sense at all. Okay. But he's already learned one thing, that taking another offering up to the mountain probably isn't going to work, because he kind of did that with, you know, Ishmael deal and the whole Sarah's handmaid deal. So he didn't try that this time. He decided to walk up the mountain, and when his son asked him, hey, where's the sacrifice at? He looks at his son and says, hey, God will provide. So he gets up there, ties him up, and literally God stops his hand from shedding his own life. And at that point, God knows that Abraham is willing and has begun the process of really trusting him and believing him and knowing that he is going to be the author of the restoration process. Not Abraham. Not Abraham's seed. God. He didn't need Abraham. There was nothing special about Abraham. God chose him because he chose him, because God wanted to choose him, not for any other reason. Ever. Keep on tracking through this. Isaac gets married, has two boys, Jacob and Esau, right? Problem is, Esau's the oldest, and he should get the blessing in it, so the promise should continue to go through Esau's, path here. But God tells, Rebecca, hey, it's actually going to be the younger who gets the blessing. So what happens? Rebecca rigs the whole deal up, says, hey, you need to get this, and so we got to make sure you get this blessing. But God does it a little differently this time, doesn't he? He allows her evil plan to go forward, doesn't he? Because Jacob does get it in spite of his own evil and his mom's own evil and rebellion. And that's an incredible principle about salvation. God does not choose people on merit, ever. He uses who he will use no matter what. I don't care what your background is. I don't care where you come from. God doesn't give a rip about where you're at. God's not looking for nice, clean-clad, morally straight people to be a part of his kingdom. Ever. He looks for the broken. And he uses the broken. And we're going to see that over and over and over again throughout the rest of the Old Testament. He starts right here and he says, Jacob. And literally, Jacob means deceiver. He takes a deceiver, a wretch of a man, to continue his plan. He gives him 12 sons. And you think Jacob would get a clue when God gives him some dreams about what's going to happen, but he doesn't. What does he do? He continues his sin by showing favoritism to his sons. And he shows his favoritism to who? Joseph, right? And Joseph knows he's got daddy's eye. Joseph knows he's got daddy's eye, and he's a little arrogant too. Whether or not you believe that's what the text says, that's exactly what the text says. He's got a little arrogance in his heart, and he goes to his brother and says, hey, you know what, this cool thing, I dreamed this the other night. And you guys are actually going to kneel at my feet one day. He uses imperfect people. And you know what? The whole process and the whole process is that he takes Joseph and, hey, the son, you know, the other sons are going, okay, this guy's out of here. We're going to sell this guy off because, you know, we feel too guilty to actually kill him, but we're going to tell daddy he's dead. And so God takes Joseph through a humbling process, doesn't he? But the process, though it was humbling and tough, ultimately led him to be the second most powerful individual in all of Egypt. Why? Because God was providing for his people. See, Joseph wasn't ready for that responsibility early on, and he kind of dug it, the knife in deep in his brother's back, but he was ready for it when it came. And he looks at his brothers and said, and his brothers are like, okay, wait a minute. We really did him wrong a long time ago. He can really mess us up. But he didn't. Because as that process of that humbling process of taking him through all that terrible situation to get him to where he was, God changed Joseph. And he said, look, God had all this in place so that I can make provision for you. We got Joseph. People go to, and then so he moves his whole family to Egypt, right? Everything looks good. Living happily in Egypt until Joseph dies. The next generation dies off, and the Egyptians start looking around and going, hey, whoa, there's a lot of these Hebrews around here. They might could take over. So I think we need to do something about this. So Pharaoh gets a little bit antsy. Says, I think we need to tell people to kill their firstborn. By the way, a mirror to the New Testament. If you ever made that connection, you should. But one spared, right? Just like Jesus was spared. One was spared. And the irony of it is he actually is raised within the palace. God's a really funny God sometimes. And so Moses starts to realize there's a whole lot of problems between the comforts in which he's living and the torture that his people are seeing. Right? So he runs off. He kills a soldier in the process, but he runs off out into the wilderness and goes and hooks up with one of his cousins and all that fun stuff. And God says, whoa, 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 Moses, I got a plan for you. You know, the burning bush deal. And and he just goes to Moses and says, hey, you need to go back. You need to rescue them. And Moses is like, whoa, 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 you know, I have a problem with this speech thing. I don't think I can go to the Pharaoh's courts. And honestly, I kind of ran out on him. I think that's my brother, my stepbrother that's ruling the king. Y'all get that, right? The Pharaoh that was ruling when Moses goes back is like his stepbrother. So, like, there's bad blood there. So there's a whole lot of other issues. There's like family issues here. But he has to go back. And God just goes back and says, whoa, you know what? I want to show you something. I'm God. I'm the hero of the story, Moses. You're not. When he says to him, and says, when we ask me who you are, what does God say to him? You tell them I am who I am. What? I am who I am? What kind of statement is that? What is God saying? You can't define me. I'm in control of the whole deal, and you can't put me in a box. I will show you, Moses, what I can do. You just go do what you're supposed to do. Moses says, all right, let's pack the bus. Let's go. Heads on back, and what happens? He goes to Pharaoh. Pharaoh won't hear anything. Plagues start happening all over. Get to the final plague. And God says, okay, go to the people, the Hebrews, and say, look, here's what you got to do. Prepare for this. You go out for a sacrifice, and you got to put the blood over the door. Okay. All right. And you know what's important about us to learn about there is that God is going to punish all sin that's not covered by blood. See, the Israelites were still sinful too. I think sometimes we put Israel in its own little box. Because if Israel wasn't sinful, then why did they need to be covered? So that night, they go, they put all the stuff over the doorways, and what does God do? He comes through and says, killing all the firstborn. All of them died that night, except for those who had the blood over their doors. Do y'all see any imagery there at all? Do you get a clue? Do we get a clue of what is happening at that moment? It's that first, one of the first most major pictures of how God will save through substitution. God will save by switching, by giving a substitute, a sacrifice on man's behalf for their sins so that they can have a united relationship with him again. Again, this Passover is only a shadow. Read Hebrews. Hebrews gives us the whole story. In fact, that's your homework this week. Go read Hebrews. It'll take you about 30 minutes. Okay? So, and from Genesis 12 till roughly Exodus 18, God's been gathering his people up. They finally get out of Egypt, and they're out there, and they're kind of heading towards the promised land, right? Well, in that promise, God finally gets them out there and get down here at the bottom of Sinai, and God says, okay, wait a minute, before you can go into the land, some things have to happen. I have to kind of form you. I have to shape you. So he sends Moses up on the mountain, and he gives Moses the law, right? Now, I want to make sure we understand this here because, again, this is one of the times we misconceive. We sometimes think that the Old Testament is about God had a whole other plan there. It didn't work out, so he sent Jesus and God fixed things. That's not what happened. The Old Testament is about a promise made. The New Testament is about a promise kept. Old Testament about a promise made. New Testament about a promise kept. And so he gets them out here at the bottom of Sinai. Of course, they're out down there, and they're having their little, you know, pagan parties while Moses is up on the mountain having a really intimate moment with God. He comes back down there, and God goes, whoa, this is serious issues, Moses. And Moses, like, goes over, cracks the cat, does the whole nine yards. Long story short is this. God gives them a law. Why is the law important? It's his rule. It's the pathway to blessing. Mankind can't just be God's people arbitrarily. They have to be God's people under his rule. Because if they're not under his rule, he can't dwell among them in blessing. So he spends the next, I don't know, let's just say Exodus 19 through roughly Leviticus, and he begins to form his people again and gives them the law and says, hey, this is how you're supposed to live. And he tells them, you are going to be a holy people for my name's sake. You are going to be shaped and formed. And the whole law was not about saving them, because God had already done that, hadn't he? He'd already done that. God had already saved his people. He had already rescued them. Of course, that was a type of an ultimate rescue from sin. But he rescued them, and he pulled them out. In Exodus 20, we read this, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Redemption and rescue had already happened for Israel in that sense. So he brings the law for what reason? He brings the law so that life and blessing could occur again. He brings the law to them so that they can come back under him and live and begin that process of becoming living in his rest again, as God shaped it in the beginning. Not only are they to live under God's rule, they are to commune with God. And here's a beautiful picture. If you ever don't understand what the tabernacle and temple thing is all about, let me tell you what it is. It's not about church. It's not just the Old Testament church versus like the New Testament church. It's not a place they went and they sung hymns and did the whole nine. No, it was a place where God's presence dwelled. The tabernacle was designed by God, and the orders were given to the priests and said, you will make this tabernacle this way. And the most important piece was the veil in there. And behind the veil, they could go once a year, right? To offer sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. But you were not allowed, no one was allowed back there except for a Levite priest, one time a year. Okay? God's presence, he wants to demonstrate that in some way God's presence is beginning to dwell among the people again. So this tabernacle is a process by which God will come and dwell among his people again. So when this tabernacle is marching through the wilderness and you see the smoke coming out of it, it's to give people hope that God is dwelling among them, and not only dwelling among them, he's leading them. towards the land. He's making his people one again. And that's the same happens. Of course, it becomes a permanent dwelling later on in the temple when in Jerusalem. We get that. All right. But one thing I really want us to get here is that out of all the promises God made thus far to the people, this was one of the only ones that was conditional. And we'll get to that here in a second, but just remember that. This is one of the conditions. If you live and obey and live under my rule, you'll be blessed. If you won't, then I'm going to take it all away. Israel. He's talking to Israel. It's a beautiful picture. But it's still a problem. Sin still hasn't been dealt with, has it? Sin still has not been dealt with. And the sin, it has to be dealt with. So God puts together this sacrificial system. We just mentioned it before. And they had different daily maintenance type, sacrifices for different types of sins. But of course, every year there was the ultimate day of atonement where two goats were slain. I mean, two goats were offered up as a sacrifice for the people. The first goat was to represent the blood spilt as a substitute for their sin. Okay? Leviticus 17:11 says this, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it for you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is in the blood that makes atonement for by the life." Jesus spilt his blood. The ultimate atonement. The ultimate sacrifice. But the second lamb, here's another picture that's beautiful. The second lamb wasn't slaughtered at all. The people came and they confessed their sins on that lamb, on that goat. And what did they do to that goat? Shoot him away, as far as he could get away. A picture of that God, when God forgives sins, it's forgiven and it's gone. It's paid for, done. Again, all this is a picture of a greater pitch down the road. There, down of Jesus, of course. And we're going to keep on tracking this thing. So then now it seems like they're ready for God's place, aren't they? Are they ready for God's place? Okay, God's been forming them and shaping them. And so from basically Numbers up through Joshua, God's preparing them to go in and take the land. Problem is that people still haven't quite got it. They don't trust God that he can take them into this land and conquer all these very powerful people over there. And also, they begin to grumble about God, to God saying, well, I don't really like this stuff that's coming from heaven. I don't like it. It don't taste good, God. Can you do something a little better? Can we have a little, filet or something? Can you hook us up, God? And they start grumbling, and they start sinning again and don't trust God again. And God says, okay, all right, obviously, you're not getting it yet. So I'm going to let your children go in. I'm going to let you guys sit out here and watch. Actually, no, none of you are going to watch. There's only one person who gets to watch. It's going to be Moses. And not even Moses could go in to the land. That's how severe God's judgment was. And so we get to the point here, and Moses gets there, and finally the generations have passed away. That generation had passed away, and Moses gets one more shot to him, and you can just kind of imagine the fear and trembling and the brokenness in his heart because his own people have not heard. They've been sojourning with God for 40 years. And he goes to him and he says, you know what? Look, me and your parents, we messed things up. Don't do that again. And go into the land, do all that God wants you to do, be his people, take it, live under his rule, live in his blessing. But then he also says the conditional. This is where we get to the conditional. Or else it's going to go away. Go and read Moses' speech at the end of Deuteronomy, or it's all going to go away. So they go in and take the land. Things look good, don't they? They go in there, they fight battles, and they realize, wait a minute, it wasn't our battle to fight. Oh, wait a minute, didn't he teach Abraham that lesson before? It's not your plan, Israel. It's my plan. I'm going to do it through you. In fact, they never even raised a sword. They just marched around the building 7 days in a row. That had to look kind of awkward. And then the walls fall down. And they stand back going, what just happened here? And they realize God is in control. And they live in this land. They take this land and they get through the whole process. They finally get the whole land to themselves. And Joshua comes to them at the end of his, near the end of his life, and he says, look, listen, God's given us everything that God has promised us, being a people, land, blessing, everything is here. It's fulfilled. Look at it in Joshua 21, 43, 45. Thus the Lord gave Israel all of the land that he swore to give them to their fathers, all of it. Okay, there's not any later fulfillment from this point on. Israel and his job is done, essentially. Not quite, but almost. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had, not one word. Everything he told Abraham is done. Done. Emphasis on past action. Done. Completed. Done. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made with him in the house of Israel had failed. All had come to pass. But then God introduces a new element here at this point, because they get out there and things look good, but then they kind of go through this little cyclical process, don't they? You remember Judges? God has to raise up all these judges all the time because, wow, the people forget God's promises. Thus, they kind of get into some sinful practices. They rebel against God, start worshiping other gods. And so then God says, they cry out, realizing that these people are trying to conquer them. And they cry out to God, you know, as their scapegoat. And God raises up a judge and says, okay, wait a minute, you know what? I still have a people that I'm trying to rescue. And so God sends judges. And over and over and over again, we see that process being lived out. Right? Finally, Israel starts looking around and going, wait a minute, we're not nations like other nations. And I kind of like what other nations are doing. And they say, what's the difference between us and them? Oh, they got kings. We don't. But God had promised them a king. And we'll talk about that here in a second. God had promised them a king. But the king that they wanted wasn't God as their king. God was pleading with them through Samuel. I am your king. You don't need an earthly king. But they wouldn't hear it, would they? And so God goes, okay, give them what they want. I'll show them how imperfect and how messed up their wants are. So he gives them Saul. Well, we all know how messed up situation that was, right? If you haven't, you need to read through it. It's pretty common, pretty crazy. But even the best of the best messed up, right? David. Look, don't make morality tales out of David's life. It's not worth your time. Don't make morality tales out of Solomon's life. It's not worth your time. It's not the purpose of David. God's trying to show him that even though David was a man after God's own heart, he still came under God's curse. Why? Because of his own sin that Nathan had to point out to him. And he looked at David and says, but because of your sin, your kingdom will eventually perish. So in other words, that conditional statement way back, says, hey, look, if you do this, things are going to go great. If you don't, it's going to all go away. He just basically tells David, hey, it's all messed up now. What's going to happen is what's going to happen. But that didn't change. David's heart changed. He was repentant and humble. But he gave David a promise. He says, but you know what? One of your sons, one of your offspring, will be the greatest king ever. It's the king that I've been trying to tell you about all along, but your people wouldn't hear anything about it. Let's look at some of the verses that talk about this king. We've already talked about the serpent crusher. We look at Jacob's blessing to his sons in Genesis 49. The scepter will not depart from Judah until he, emphasis on he, comes to who it belongs, and the obedience of nations are his. Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20. It's a little bit longer, but let's read through it. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set my king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you to whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers who you shall set as a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself. In other words, he is not to be a man who loves riches and the power and the prestige of this world. Okay? And he should not return you to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. In other words, he shouldn't lead you in such a path that you walk away from the rescue that you've received in Jesus. I mean, in God. Okay? By the way, ultimately all the kings did that. They got money hungry, and they led them away from the rescue that God had for his people. Ahab, even Solomon, worshipped other gods and just go through the track record. Finally, God said judgment was coming, and he says, this is the king. There is a greater king. An earthly king cannot stand in that place. God's promise of a king is a subset then. Really, it's not a new fourth rung. It's actually the subset under God's rule and blessing. Because the king would not only rule, but he would be a blessing to his people because he would dwell among them. Who did that? Jesus. So the kingdom's falling apart. Right? The kingdom's falling apart. Prophets are telling them, hey, look, you know what? You're messing this whole thing up. Turn, change. Of course, at this point, it's long on its path of fulfillment, right? It's already been told to David, hey, your kingdom's going to break. Going to break down. Here's the key. But all along, the prophets were telling them, hey, change, whatever, but he also tagged on some stuff. But when you do fail, it's kind of weird. Turn, hey, but when you do fail, know that God's got some other plan in place. It's a greater plan. It's a greater Israel. It's a greater land. It's a greater Jerusalem. It's not an earthly Jerusalem. It's not an earthly Israel. It's a heavenly people. It's a heavenly person for the people. It's a heavenly dwelling place. It's a heavenly rule. That's what a lot of these prophets, let's look at some of them as they pertain to our pattern real quick, and then we're going to finish up. God's people, then, are talked about throughout the prophets. Isaiah 10, 20 through 21 tells us about a remnant that will be preserved. In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean on him who struck them, in other words, their captivity, but will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return. The remnant of Jacob to the mighty God. Well, of course, that meant a remnant that would be preserved until the 400 years of silence. There's some truth to that as well. But there's also an ultimate remnant. The remnant's a church. Isaiah 53, 5 through 6. But he who is wounded, and who's this Lord, by the way? By the way, that they're talking about up here in Isaiah 10. 53, he was wounded for our transgression. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Jesus would be the representative head of all humanity. Adam, like Adam, who was the representative head in which sin, all sin came through Adam and Eve. Right? Jesus would be a new representative head for all those who would be redeemed. And all we have to do to get redemption is say, Jesus paid it all. Jesus paid it all. He is the people. Isaiah 49, 6. Not only is he going to provide salvation for Israel, okay, for the rebellion of Israel, that he's trying to comfort them in Isaiah. But Isaiah 49, 6, we give a step back. He says, Is it too light of a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to bring back the preserved of Israel? I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach the end of the earth. So the salvation is not just for Israel. In fact, really, they're just there to be a line to get to Jesus. It's for all peoples, the people who were dispersed at Babel. All nations. Okay, so that's talking about God's people. Okay, so Jesus is going to be God's people. He's a representative head for God's people so that they can live in peace with God and rest with God. Well, what about God's place? Ezekiel had noticed at the exile in one of his prophecies in Ezekiel 10 that the glory of God had removed from the temple. So when they come back and they rebuild everything, guess what happens? Nothing. Their celebrations are empty. You know why? Because God doesn't dwell among them any longer. His purposes, back in Joshua, says everything that God had said came to pass, had come to pass for that point and moment in time. God doesn't live among buildings and brick and mortar and temples and tabernacles. Jesus is the temple and tabernacle. I wonder if you get it. Remember when he goes into the temple, Jesus does, and he flips over their tables, and everyone's like, who's this guy? What does he think he is? They look at him and says, who do you think you are? And he says, 3 days. It takes me three days. And I'll rebuild the temple. What was he talking about? His death. Jesus is the place. Jesus is the place. He's going to be the doorway to the new heavens and the new world. Ezekiel 40:48, after he says this, and he gives great hope, he says that there will be a one who will be a temple who will give life to the world. Who is that? It's Jesus. Jesus is going to give life to the world. That new temple, that perfect temple, is going to be giving life to the new whole world. The vision is too amazing then. It can't be just for a mere building. Isaiah 65, "For behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, a new Jerusalem, not an earthly Jerusalem, and her people to be a gladness." We are to be a gladness to the world. The church, redeemed in Christ, are to be a joy to the world. We're to bring joys to all the nations. So God's rule and blessing then comes back. And we keep on going, tracking on through this here real quick. Jeremiah 31 says this. It's a new covenant. He gives us an idea. There's a new covenant. It's not going to be a complete restart of the covenant God's been given. It's just going to be a fulfilled covenant. Okay? And Ezekiel 31 says this. This is what the new covenant will involve. "I will put my law, not as an outside thing, but in their minds. And I will write it on their hearts." It's an inside transformation, not an outside transformation any longer. Joel says the same thing in Joel 2. "And the new covenant will come at the hands of a king." Isaiah 9, 6 through 7. "For unto us is born, to us a son is given. The government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore." Psalm 101, "And the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand." This is David talking. "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool." David writes this psalm, and it's what we call a Christological psalm, or different ways you can say that. And basically it is that the Lord said to my Lord, the Lord said to my Lord. What Lord is David talking about? My Lord. It means something greater than a mere man. And you will sit at my right hand until your enemies are a footstool. And the new covenant will usher in a new complete blessing. Look at this, Amos 9. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes him who sows the seed. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all of the hills shall flow from it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel," a new Israel, a perfect Israel, the church, Israel, church, same, okay, got it. "And they shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards and drink their wine, and they will make gardens and eat their fruit." There's a more magnificent new heavens and new earth coming our way. I think it's going to be really cool. I get to drink wine in heaven. Sorry. All right. Fulfilled kingdom. All right. Just had to be said. All right. Fulfilled kingdom then. Let's finish this up. We had this long, dark night, 400 years. People have been longing, not just 400 years, but from way back in Genesis. They've been longing for the completion, for a restoration of what God created things from the very beginning. So then who is this Jesus? Here's your blanks. Jesus is God's people. He is God's people. There is no people who do not come from under Jesus. Ever. End of story. He is the representative head of all mankind. We've already said that. Second, he is God's place. Through him, the new heavens and new earth will be created. He will usher in a new Eden and the long-awaited plan of God. There will be a complete restoration, a better Eden than what we were given in the beginning. And he is God's rule and blessing. He is the great King of Kings. He is the Word made flesh from John 1. And he dwelt among us. He is the tabernacle. The temple. It's amazing stuff, isn't it? How we can never be encouraged by the Old Testament. How we can just go to the Old Testament and say, "Oh, you know, maybe I, you know, it's too confusing for me." It's not. If you can't preach Jesus out of it, don't preach it. Everything is about Jesus. And with that said, let's watch this video and prepare our hearts for Lord's Supper.
what is the Bible really about? Is the Bible basically about me and what I must do? Or is it basically about Jesus and what he has done? When you read in Luke and Acts how Jesus, in those 40 days, got his disciples together, 40 days before he ascended, after he was raised, what was he doing? Basically, he was saying, everything in the Old Testament is about me. He says, the reason you didn't understand what I was about was you didn't realize that everything in the prophets and the Psalms and the law was pointing to me. Do you believe the Bible is basically about you or basically about him? Is David and Goliath basically about you and how you can be like David and Goliath, or basically about him, the one who really took on the only giants that can really kill us? And so his victory is imputed to us. Who's it really about? That's the fundamental question. And when that happens, then you start to read the Bible new. You know, Jesus is the true and better Adam who passed the test in the garden, his garden, a much tougher garden, and whose obedience is imputed to us. Jesus is the true and better Abel, who, though innocently slain, has blood that cries out, not for our condemnation, but for our acquittal. Jesus is the true and better Abraham, who answered the call of God to leave all the comfortable and familiar and go into the void, not knowing whither he went. Jesus is the true and better Isaac, who was not just offered up by his father on the mount, but was truly sacrificed for us all, while God said to Abraham, now I know you love me, because you did not withhold your son, your only son, whom you love from me. Now we at the foot of the cross can say to God, now we know that you love me, because you did not withhold your son, your only son, whom you love from me. Jesus is the true and better Jacob, who wrestled and took the blow of justice we deserve, so we, like Jacob, only receive the wounds of grace that wake us up and discipline us. Jesus is the true and better Joseph, who is at the right hand of the king and forgives those who betrayed and sold him and uses his power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Moses, who stands in the gap between the people and the Lord and who mediates a new covenant. Jesus is the true and better rock of Moses, who, struck with the rod of God's justice, now gives us water in the desert. Jesus is the true and better Job. He's a truly innocent sufferer who then intercedes for and saves his friends. Jesus is the true and better David, whose victory becomes his people's victory, though they never lifted a stone to accomplish it themselves. Jesus is the true and better Esther, who didn't just risk losing an earthly palace, but lost the ultimate heavenly one, who didn't just risk his life, but gave his life. Who didn't just say, if I perish, I perish, says, when I perish, I'll perish for them, to save my people. Jesus is the true and better Jonah, who was cast out into the storm so we could be brought in. He's the real Passover lamb. He's the true temple, the true prophet, the true priest, the true king, the true sacrifice, the true lamb, the true light, the true bread. The Bible's not about you.